We've got Andy Levy from Cirque du Soleil. Andy heads up the social media efforts at Cirque. You do not, just to clarify, wear any kind of tights to work. Is that correct? You don't do any tricks?
Only on Fridays.
Only on Fridays. In advance, the connection is a little bit spotty, so I apologize if the audio or video starts to crap out a little bit. So if you weren't working for an entertainment entity, something that's so engaging and has all this cool stuff and pageantry, let's say you were working, and I've used this example in my speaking engagements, Charmin, right? Toilet paper. People are going to go no matter what, but are they going to buy Charmin? And then if you were running the social media team of a brand like that, that's, you know, kind of a premium brand in a utility category, how would your approach be different? What would you be thinking about when, you know, it's not something, I mean, yeah, maybe the huggable character on TV is great, the Charmin, whatever, bear, or whatever it is, but you have a lot less to work with. So I guess, how right. would your mindset change then if you had to take it from that angle?
I think it's something where I'd have to take a step back and kind of digest the brand and digest its, and digest is a bad term for a toilet paper company, but
digestion is done by then.
Yes, but just understand the scope and where they're placed and what their goal and objective is. I mean, you're not going to answer customer service questions for a toilet paper company, and if you do, that's got to be the most interesting thing ever. So maybe there's an opportunity there. You know, the cuddly characters, that does appeal to someone. So how do you leverage that? That's a great, tough question. I mean, hopefully I would never be in that position, but it's tough. And you look at a lot of these brands, and I think the thing that most brands fall into that really disturbs me is that they don't own the brand. They don't understand, hey, this is your niche to carve out. Instead, they kind of they apply this, like this, if you like wiping your butt with Charmin, you know, that kind of model. And I see that too many times throughout brands that don't have a clear vision, and it really drives me nuts. So if I were to take on a less sexy brand per se, I would take a step back and say, who are we? What are we trying to accomplish through these channels? And how are we going to carve our niche? And how are we going to speak to our fans? And how are we going to distinguish ourselves from the other toilet paper brands?
So, you know, what I found is, you know, I kind of tend to deconstruct these things because I look at it from, you know, from an innovation business perspective, not necessarily, you know, I'm not just liking randomly online. Right. So when I see these campaigns, you know, a lot of them seem very fluffy or trite, or you're just plain trying to buy people off, right? So you're trying to give them, you know, some sort of prize, or you do a trade like this and get a prize, or maybe enter this competition or something like that. But it seems like, you know, there's always some percentage of the audience that's willing to obey and do any little thing that the brand says. But I would say that most thinking people, and certainly people in business, probably see through that. So how do you keep that, you know, from being such a false, phony type of interaction?
I mean, for us, we view it as a science. We don't view it as like, hey, we're going to post this and we're going to get 1,000 likes. For us, there's a science behind it. Especially for Facebook, it's our number one direct response channel right now through social, and it's getting up there in online as well. We drive towards our website. We drive towards people converting to Cirque Club, which is our fan club. Drive towards people buying tickets, and the numbers we see from that are staggering. I mean, we see any campaigns go from 5 times ROI to, we just had one that wrapped up that was 16 times ROI return on investment. So the more we can carve out of that business intelligence and actionable data, the more we can go back and apply that to the enterprise, not just online, but offline too.
Yeah, you know, I was I was thinking about, I don't know if you read this, but I think it was a week or two ago, Mark Cuban wrote a blog post about how he's getting the hell off of Facebook.
So
it's just for those who didn't hear it, Mark's point is that, you know, all these brands invested, or at least this is his premise, invested all this money more or less under false pretenses, thinking that these are their fans and they're going to, you know, they invested all this money to get to their fans once they've liked their page. So there's a certain expectation that they're going to see that brand's posts pretty regularly. But when you look at the actual numbers for Facebook, it's maybe 10 or 15% that actually do see the average post, and maybe even less for certain brands. So do you feel wronged? Do you feel, you know, because I certainly, for my business and on a personal level, you know, I get frustrated. Well, why aren't people seeing my posts if they're my friends?
I don't feel wronged. I mean, it's... We've all signed up for Facebook. We've all agreed to their terms and conditions. I know that's a later topic, but it's something that we have to play their game. I mean, I know there's, you know, over 950 million people on Facebook, and I know there's this idea of democracy, but at the same time, it's their platform, and they can choose to do whatever they want with it. We just have to comply with it. And people are going to keep complying with it. I mean, and people will always complain about it. They'll never be happy. But like, you know, I did some research on this too, because I read the article and I was concerned, and then I did the research. And if you look at a lot of the research, like it's the same level of percentage that it's been for the past couple of years, where if you're posting something as a brand, you're reaching probably 14 to 16% of your audience. And it is what it is. And that's one thing that we've educated our team internally here too, is that when you post something, not everyone sees it. You're not going to reach a million people, you know, every single time. You just can't. There's different times of day. People are online different times of day. So there are a lot of factors that, you know, go into it. I don't think people understand, like, the whole scope of it. And we've found that, yes, we build up our fan base and we convert, you know, the fan base that we currently have. But our goal is always to keep building and building and building.
So, you know, when you think about the level of dependency that you have, now obviously these companies created a market, so they don't owe you anything, right? Whether you're Cirque du Soleil or Steve Factor or Idea Factor or American Express or whoever. So they've created something that didn't exist before. You could say the same thing about, you know, Google and search. Maybe they didn't create the category, but they certainly dominate the category now. You know, isn't there a certain monopoly power that's developing on these platforms? So you look at Twitter, and they did a complete 180. So it used to be this open, hug me, love me type of platform where you could build almost anything on it, to now they're saying, come to our site, and if you get more than 100,000 users, talk to us, and we'll decide whether you live or die. So what's your reaction to this level of control and dependency, and does anyone have a right to any kind of righteous indignation on this subject?
I mean, the growth in monopoly is inevitable. I mean, I don't know if anyone is going to come along right now, at least, and you know, push these companies out of the way. I mean, they're growing too big, and you know, with Facebook being public and Twitter at some point, I'm guessing, will go public. Like, they're going to become these big monolith companies. And if you see, like, all the Googles and the Salesforce and the Oracles of the world buying these kind of creating these enterprise-wide solutions as well, like, it's only going to get bigger. But at the same time, I think it might not get better from the small business user, but from, you know, the big brand, like, it's a lot better, because you're going to have all this business intelligence, which is extremely important for us, that you're going to be able to understand. And I guess to the second part of your question, people are always going to complain. There's nothing we can do about it. But you've signed up for these platforms. So until you go out and create your own platform and then go through this whole cycle again, like, I don't think there's much you can do. I mean, if you want to boycott Twitter, boycott Twitter. If you want to boycott Facebook, boycott Facebook. There's still, you know, 600 million other people that will be on those platforms, and more people day in, day out.
Well, let's speculate a little bit about Twitter. So Twitter hasn't ever made money. They've started doing some sponsored tweets, and they're essentially, their strategy now is to become a media company. So they're trying to draw you into their platform so they can, you know, whatever, show you ads, sponsored tweets, get you to buy those kinds of things. So I just wonder if, you know, this is, it seems to me like it's an example of a company that is visibly large, but is in effect much, much smaller and less successful than the perception because of its visibility. So a perfect analogy is show business. So everyone, you know, show business just by definition is in your face. It's on TV. It's on the, you know, on the radio. It's in movie theaters. So everyone thinks, I want to be a star. I want to be in show business. So they all go out to California, but then you realize that, you know, there's only maybe 100 or 150,000 people that are making a living in show business. Everyone else is struggling and not making money. So I wonder if there's a magnitude disparity where you've got this perception of largeness and success, but the reality is much more modest and humble. What's your take on that?
No, I completely agree with that analogy. I mean, if you look at Facebook, you know, they're getting publicly berated for a lot of things and for going public. But at the same time, a lot of people are on them, and for us at least, they've been a great direct response platform, and we do advertise with them, and we do see the results, and it works for us. It may not work for someone like GM, who says, we'll never do Facebook ads, but think about it. Are you going to buy a car through a Facebook ad? I mean, you're never going to see the ROI on that. You know, if you're spending millions of an ad on an ad, is someone going to go and buy a $40,000 vehicle on it? I mean, it has to be the right fit for your brand. And for Twitter, we love Twitter. It's a great source for us, but we found it to be much more informational and much more of a, like you said, a media hub and a news feed, really, for us. And a great, it's actually for us also a great way to engage in real time with our fans and other brand ambassadors. But for me, like, I see the most opportunity and also the most risk with Twitter, because it's, where are they going to go? What can they do next? Because for them, like, it's that huge feed and stream of information, but what are they going to do? Because whatever they do next, like, it's got to be similar to a Facebook or a MySpace or even a Google Plus, just because, like, I don't know what else you can do with that platform right now, aside from that news feed.
Well, you know, that's the irony of that type of business, because the users, they need a mass consumer to use it. However, the value is to companies, not to the consumers.
Right.
So consumers, I mean, the utility you get out of Twitter, in my estimation, is minimal. It's great if you're a celebrity and you can engage with a mass audience very easily. That's great. And if you're a fan of a celebrity, you can reach out and hope that, you know, Kim Kardashian responds to your tweet, and that'll make your day, and you can go
right.
Call your friends. But for most people, they can live without it. If Twitter disappeared, we'd be fine with it. But what's amazing is all these corporations are now analyzing and, you know, dissecting and doing all this analysis on people's moods and what they, you know, what they're feeling about whatever subject at any given time. They're, you know, one thing that they're doing is natural language. I forgot the exact term, and I don't want to try to remember, but it's some kind of semantics and analysis where they're trying to see, well, are you having a positive or a negative experience with a given brand? So
yeah.
It seems like a lot of work for very little value to the user that you depend upon.
Yeah, it's a tough situation. I mean, I don't think in any history of any business, especially in marketing, has there been so much actionable data that you can digest. But it's digesting through all that data and saying, okay, what does this mean? What is the value of this? And what do we do with it? How do we capitalize off of it, or how do we understand it, or how do we change? And we found that with some channels, but Twitter is much harder, honestly. And that's not a slight on Twitter. It's just there's not that much data available.
Yeah, so I was going to ask you now, you know, since companies are trying to suck this platform for any kind of insights, I wonder if they're dealing with a selection bias. So my thinking on this is there's a type of person, you know, I've been delving really deep into the psychology of these things. I'm actually writing a new post on, you know, the different personality types that are on Twitter. And to me, you know, there's a certain type of person that's motivated by fame or some kind of outlet that they're either not getting elsewhere. So it becomes a currency of sorts. So, you know, that's kind of the subject of my speech at the NMX conference coming up in January. But the question is, are you seeing real people, or are you seeing a subset of humanity that is motivated differently from other people?
I like how you call it subset of humanity. That's a great term for it. For us, from a brand perspective, we see real people. And that's what I love about it. We get to interact with, you know, fans as they're there at the shows, whether it's a resident show or a moving show, whatever it is. And that's what I love about it from a brand. From a personal use and a consumer use, I do see that subset of humanity. You see people who will come in and email us and say, hey, give me tickets, I have 100,000 Twitter followers. And I say, okay, like, what does that mean? Do you have 100,000, like, you know, people in, you know, Malaysia that like you, or do you have 100,000 people in, you know, New York or LA or London? So I think it's, there's two ways. I see the value in it as currency because if you're a brand and someone is of value, you want them to come to your show or come to your restaurant or whatever, and you want them to talk about it. But at the same time, you can't just accept the fact that someone has X amount of followers and they're this person. Just because it's not always relevant. And I know there's, you know, controversies with you know, the credit systems like clout and cred and all that stuff. But those things do add depth and perspective to it. So at least you know, okay, maybe they're influential in certain topics. It's challenging. And the other thing too is, honestly, like, I like to meet with all these people in person because it's interesting to see who they are online versus who they are offline. And most of the time it doesn't always match, and I'm always surprised when it does. It's nice when it does, because it's nice to say, okay, this person's personality is just the way they are on Twitter, or when you meet, wow, this person has no personality whatsoever. So it's interesting.
You know, let's you kind of touched on it a little bit. Let's talk a little bit about the phony follower scenario, because, you know, I don't know if you've used these tools, but there are a couple of them where you can run someone's Twitter profile through this tool, and it'll tell you what percentage of their followers are either inactive or fake or real. So, you know, I don't know if you've had a chance to use them, but I've run a few people's profiles. And so this is where I get suspicious. So if people seem to have a lot of followers, but no retweets or no engagement on Google Plus or Facebook, then something's wrong. So either they're buying those followers, or, you know, or people like them but hate to interact with them, which makes no sense.
Right. No, it's funny. Like, I know a few people that, like, either worked with me in a previous role and or said, oh, social media, that's BS, you know, don't invest in it. And all of a sudden now they have, like, 10,000 Twitter followers, and they're not famous people. They're not industry leaders. They're not business leaders. So, I don't know. It creates a false sense of worth. it drives me nuts because, like, I'd love more Twitter followers, but I'm not going to go out and solicit it. I'm not going to go out and pay for it. Like, if people want to follow me, they're more than welcome to follow me. But, like, to get 10,000 Twitter followers who are all Bieber fans that, you know, you have nothing to do with and will never engage with you, I mean, it's pointless. It's like if we went to, instead of going to NMX, we went to, like, the fashion conference and we spoke on the same topic. Like, no one's going to care. So for me, it's about, I don't care if you have a million Twitter followers. It's got to be, those followers are relevant and they engage with you. I mean, because that's why you should have a million Twitter followers, not because you, like, went out and paid for it. I mean, anyone can do that. That's, there's no talent or skill set behind that.
Well, let's talk about the strategy here. Is there value to being perceived as a winner or as popular? Because, you know, there could be. So I'm trying to figure out if there's a psychological defect that forces you to go out and pretend like people like you. The equivalent. It's a social media equivalent of going to a strip club. But even there, you get something more out of it because you go to a strip club, you're paying someone to like you for whatever, for 5 minutes at a
yes.
time. So you're doing the same thing on social media.
It's like high school. And I think if you, like, psychologically go back, I mean, most of these people who are, like, extremely popular were probably not popular in high school or in college or whatever. So I think there's something to that. I think it is a popularity contest. You want to say you have 100,000 or a million Twitter followers. You want to feel important. And you want to, like, the bigger those followers get, the bigger you're, like, head gets in that self sense of worth. So you want to go into a restaurant and be like, comp my meal. I've got 100,000 Twitter followers. I'm going to tell them you suck if you don't. And that's where you as the business or the brand have to look at it and say, okay, you have 100,000 Twitter followers. What does your blog look like? What does your Google Plus profile look like? What is your Facebook do you have a Facebook profile or do you have a Facebook fan page? So you have to look at all the factors, and you know, we do use items like clout and cred to say, okay, are they influential and what are they influential in? I know that those aren't perfect systems, but at the same time, like, it saves us a lot of time and research to look through those. But you have to have the full spectrum. You can't just go goo-goo or gaga over someone having X amount of followers. And a lot of brands do, unfortunately, especially smaller brands. So small businesses, they'll go nuts. Like, if you go into, like, a local coffee shop and someone has, like, 50,000 Twitter followers, they'll be like, yeah, please tweet about us. And it might not be relevant. The other thing, too.
Hello?
About us, but it doesn't result in their followers converting to us.
Yeah, and I've had this debate with someone who is an expert in this field, or everyone's calling themselves an expert in this field, so that's not even...
That's an annoyance, too, for me. It's like, I've been in this field for a while. I don't consider myself an expert. It's the wild, wild west, so we're constantly learning. So anyone who, especially in any of their profiles, labels themselves as a guru and an expert is, like, telling you, like, I have no clue what this is, in my opinion.
Well, and this is the debate we were having, and I won't reveal who it is, but this person was saying that you can sell through social media, and I think that's the silliest thing in the world because you don't sell through social media. You maybe influence, you inform, you kind of tease or whet their appetite a little bit, but you certainly don't, you know, so you might be able to sell if you're, you know, offering some crazy deal and everyone just runs and clicks on it. If Amazon or Starbucks offers, you know, some 50% off deal, you're gonna do it. So they're not buying, they're buying your love. They're not getting real engagement. But if you're gonna get, let's say, someone with 100,000 followers and high engagement to say, I love Cirque du Soleil. Well, if you live in Peoria and have no plans to visit New York or Vegas or any of the places where you have shows in the next year, then maybe you planted a seed. But if you're a company and you're depending on that person to show up somewhere and pay you money, you're out of luck.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, for us, we actually do believe you can sell through social media, but it's not a global It's not a global sell. If you're going to sell through social media, you have to target your audience. And for us, we have two approaches. With our resident shows, we look for people who are coming to Vegas. For our touring shows, we go into that market. So we look at that market and say, okay, we're going into Boston. What are similarly priced spectacles or items that people in Boston would do, similar to a Cirque show? Well, maybe they'll go to a Patriots game. Maybe they'll go to a Red Sox game. Maybe they'll go to a museum. So we start looking at those types of people and targeting them. But to say, hey, I got Kim Kardashian and she's going to give us a shout out, it's not going to do anything for you. I mean, it might expose your brand to a new set of eyes, but you're not going to sell tickets right away. I mean, or sell that product right away. You can eventually, but most people don't get it in that it's a year-long, always-on kind of approach. And it's great to involve ambassadors, and that's a program that we're doing is involving ambassadors, but we're doing it in a much natural way as opposed to like hard sell Kim Kardashian sells snow tires type of thing.
So what does an ambassador do for Cirque du Soleil? What's the relationship like?
So for us, we've looked at a lot of people who are fans of our brand. So there is a natural connection there. And that's important. We can't just go get Kanye West and say, oh, I love Cirque. We want people who have talked to us before and become fans and express their interest. So we reach out to them and say, hey, do you want to do this? Do you want to participate in this event that we're doing? And most of the time they're very excited. And for us, it's awesome because, you know, to hear that someone of a certain stature is just as big a fan as we are of them, it's really cool and it's a great alignment. And so for us, the goal isn't really a hard sell. It's really to say, hey, this person can do this and can be a part of this brand, and so can you eventually, or so can your fans. And so that's kind of, for 2013, something that we're working on more and more.
Is this another situation where you're a fortunate beneficiary of working for an entertainment-oriented company? Will Charmin have the same success with its ambassador program?
Probably not. Yeah, I don't think Charmin would have the same effect unless it was someone who was like a supermodel or something. I think that's the only way, and you were appealing to men. We are, like I said, every day I'm very lucky to work at Cirque, and yeah, I mean, we're extremely lucky to have the brand we have and to have the fans that we have.
A last question, because we've gone over the half hour, but only because we started late. I want to get your thoughts on Google Plus. So we're using this platform right now. You know, I've been on it for a while. I think it's great. There's a lot of smart people on here, and I actually think that Hangouts could be a killer app. But I still feel like it is a very sparse landscape, and it's still very niche-y in terms of the communities and types of people who engage on it. What's your feeling on it? It doesn't feel like a hospitable place for business. I see a lot of posts about politics. I see a lot of posts about, you know, rants about all kinds of things that aren't business. They're not social because you're not interacting with your friends. Your friends aren't on Google Plus in most cases. So I guess it's this sort of engagement platform where strangers find like-minded strangers, and hopefully, you know, maybe they develop friendships, but that's really not the nature of how it started. So is there hope for it? What's been your assessment and usage of the platform?
Yeah, it's tough. We use it. I believe there's a huge benefit to using it because of Google search, and your content will populate first from Google Plus, so you have to keep it relevant. And then the YouTube factor as well. I mean, I think Google has a great, great platform between search, social, and YouTube. I really think, though, they need to ramp up either whatever they're going to do with Google Plus or just market the hell out of it, just because I think there are great opportunities there. The Hangout is a great idea. You know, we've explored doing it with some things, but it's challenging because some people don't believe in it. Some people don't understand it. Why can't we just broadcast it? Why can't we do it on Facebook? Why can't we do it on Twitter? So I think it really, from what I've seen, yeah, it's found a niche in terms of social media professionals and business professionals, but I don't think it's found its niche in terms of consumers. I think it's more people who understand the industry, but I think that's for Google to really, you know, or us to tell Google and say, hey, you need to make this more consumer friendly, because I don't think it is right now. And the execution and the idea is there, especially with the search component, especially if your content's going to populate first in search, you want to own that space. It's just, if people are going to that space and not educated, or it doesn't become second nature to them, it's going to be tough. I don't know. I think there's a great opportunity for it and a lot of possibilities, but I think they have a long road ahead of them.
Yeah, on a personal level, I like the way that it's that allows long form engagement. I think it's somewhere between social and blogging, whereas. Yeah. You know, Twitter, the interactions, as you said, it's very hard to build up any kind of rapport or any meaningful conversation. You've only got 140 characters, and they're kind of flying at each other like this.
Yep.
So I think that, you know, on Facebook, again, you know, the people that you're friends with or are in your family aren't necessarily the people who you have anything in common with. And then there's LinkedIn, which is basically for work. So then, you know, Google Plus is in this sort of interesting gray area of not quite work, not quite personal, but something intellectual. And I feel like they're not hitting the nail right now, whatever that
is. Yeah, and that's a great point that you bring up, is the intellectual part. And I think if they wanted to and they marketed it right, this could be the total industry, whatever industry you're in, whether it's social media, online, law, insurance, this could be the industry type of mechanism.
Yeah, yeah. All right, Andy, it's been a pleasure. This is a little bit of a teaser. I'm doing a speech on social currency, and then I'm going to be moderating this panel where you're going to be one of the featured participants, as well as a couple of other people. I think there's someone from Salesforce and the CEO of Cloud. So we'll get to grill him a little bit. I'm actually going to talk to him next week. It's a long day, the sun and the moon. Everybody's running for that great big tune. Who said it won't be long when everybody's running for that great big song? But Andy, I have a confession to make. I have never been to a Cirque du Soleil show. Will you hold this against me during the course of our conversation?
No, I will not. You know, our goal is to really reach an audience that hasn't been reached before. We have our core fans, but we also have fans that we need to reach as well. So we would consider you one of our fans that we haven't reached yet, but we will convert soon enough.
Okay, so I'm getting about two-thirds of what you're saying, unfortunately, because of the connection. we'll power through it. Tell me about your fans, because I know my parents are fans of yours, and they've certainly seen at least six shows or some variations of going six times, but they have no clue how to use any social media. So clearly they're not your designated target for social media. Who are the people who talk to you online?
Usually we see really our hardcore fans, and we view that as probably the demo, like 25 to 40, 44. And there are fans that have seen multiple shows. They've seen shows, you know, anywhere from 5 times to 25 times. It could be the same show 25 times, or it could be a different iteration. And, you know, our goal is really to keep the memories and keep the emotions going after you've seen a Cirque show. We talk to them before they go to see a Cirque show. We talk to them while they're editors for a show, when they're at intermission, they'll tweet or they'll post the show was awesome, and we'll jump into that conversation. And then afterwards, they'll talk to us as well, saying, oh, I can't believe it. But our real goal is to keep that conversation going when they're not at the show, to get them excited or to evoke the emotions and memories of the show 3 months after they've seen the show or 6 months after they've seen the show, to get them excited for the next time or to get them to go another time.
So how do you get someone excited over Twitter? It sounds really good, and certainly, you have levers that other people don't have, right? So because you're entertainment oriented, you can show clips, you can do things that that some other brands just can't. So do you think that's an advantage? And what do you do to kind of what's your foreplay for Cirque du Soleil for future shows?
Yeah, we're extremely lucky because we have a lot of rich content, and sometimes it's very daunting because there's so much of it you don't even know what to distribute or what's going to get fans excited. So I consider myself certainly lucky. I don't run for an accounting firm or for a law firm or for bug spray. So we definitely have a sexy brand. And for us, we put ourselves in the mindset of the fan, and the fan is, what's really going to appeal to this fan? And if I was a major fan of a brand and I tweet at them or I talk about them and they don't respond, then, do you care as much about that brand? And if you talk to a brand and they do respond to you through Twitter or Facebook or whatever, how do you feel? Does it cement that bond that you have with them? If you wrote something to Nike or Red Bull, one of your favorite brands, and they said, thanks for liking our brand, or glad you enjoyed that, or hey, let's help you out. Like, how would you feel? So that's kind of the mindset we have, is that it's a combination of the rich content that we have, and also knowing that letting our fans be heard and listening to them.